Dario Robleto, let me begin by asking you to explain this term that you use to describe yourself, a materialist poet. What is that in opposition to, say, a sculptor?
Well, my practice always seemed to dabble in many different fields, and saying I was a sculptor only never felt quite right. Saying I was a poet only didn't feel quite right, or for that matter, a scientist or a historian. I have a lot of passions, and so I decided one day to just come up with the term that seemed to best fit my practice. And there is at the core of an investigation of materials and tapping unlock meaning within them. And for me, that often has a strong relationship to language. So for example, something I do that's kind of backwards for most object makers is that I always write my titles and my material lists first. And I don't even know what I'm going to make half the time. It doesn't matter at that point. It's simply about the act of writing.
So you begin with a very whimsical, improvisational word game with yourself. And then you saddle yourself into a long, meticulous, arduous process of turning that into a physical reality.
Yes. And often I create problems for myself because I don't even know if it exists half the time. Glass produced by lightning, you know. I didn't know if that existed. It turns out it does. It's a beautifully rare, strange substance on our planet called fulgurites, or trinitite, and that began with a wordplay about an atomic explosion turning the desert to glass. Turns out there is such a thing called trinitite, which is glass produced by an atomic explosion when the heat literally melts the blast site to glass at the impact site. So, remarkably, I'd say, even though I give myself these strange problems, I almost always solve them. And it just, every time I think I've found the last incredibly strange and obscure magical material on the planet, I'm quickly corrected. There's a million more.
Well, Dario Robleto, here we are in the front room gallery of the Contemporary Wing at the BMA, and we are surrounded by these puzzles to which you've come up with incredible visual solutions, and I wonder if you might just give us a tour around the room and talk about some of the highlights in here.
Okay. Let's start with one that maybe people could quickly visualize, which is a series of prints. There are eight large prints on the wall, and these, if you can picture in your head, an album cover, and specifically live album covers. As a music fan, I've always had a passion for live albums, for a variety of reasons. But picture in your own catalog what maybe a live album in your own back catalog. And more than likely, it's going to be an image of a singer standing on stage in the act of singing, usually sweating, and with strong stage lights illuminating them. So what I've done for this piece, I've taken eight select live album covers, chosen very specifically by different musicians, all who have passed away. And I've removed everything, the singer and all the text, except the stage lights that illuminated them. So what you end up getting look very much like NASA astronomical photographs.
Which, coincidentally, here we are right around the corner from the Hubble headquarters.
Yes, and this piece directly, Hubble, I would say, is deeply influenced for this interesting thing. Everybody knows this basic premise that when we look at a star, we're seeing it as it once was because of the time it takes for the light to arrive here. NASA's, you know, on this incredible quest of how far back in time can we actually see. They're currently at 13.2 billion years that we can see starlight that old. But meditating on this idea that we're looking out into the sky at light on its way to us, it occurred to me one day, if something's looking our way, of course our light is heading their way as well. So it became this metaphor about the stage light that illuminated Jimi Hendrix on a concert in 1969. As it bounced off his body, it is still on its way somewhere. And if something were looking this way, all the light would be slowly hitting it, that consciousness, at a pace where they can experience the event in real time again. But it was an idea of, you know, playing off the idea of a star, the birth and death of a star.
Right, because the light that we see from those extremely distant stars is a light from a star that no longer exists. Exactly. Those stars are dead, even though we're just seeing their light now.
Exactly, and in that way, there's a beautiful philosophy here in that everything's still alive somewhere.
Dario Robleto, you have, it seems to me, a fascination with recorded sound, artifacts of recording media. And I know there's another piece here that has to do with records that have been reconstituted in some way. I wonder if we might look at that next.
Sure. And this, I'd just quickly say, it's from my passion as a DJ and DJ background. One of the beautiful discrepancies that I meditate on a lot as far as sensory experiences of the past. So as we said with Hubble, we can sense through vision light that is 13.2 billion years old. But a sound, up until only a few years ago, we could never break the 1878 barrier. Edison didn't invent sound recording technology until 1877. The earliest surviving recordings are probably 1878. Just think about that. I mean, as far as how we access the past, the discrepancy between sight and sound are so vast as to just be an abstraction. 13.2 billion as opposed to a century and a half.
With that in mind, let's try to paint a verbal picture of this particular display. I mean, we're looking at this lucite case that's full of all these porcelain blues and pearlescent whites, all these, they almost look like museum artifacts in some sort of old-timey glass domed sarcophaguses. What are these objects and how are they made?
Well, there are dozens and dozens of objects on here. There's things like seashells, butterflies, carved bone elements. There are all kinds of rocks and minerals and crystals that formed in caves. It really is about the material of the world. So it's kind of a traveling museum itself. But I wanted to paint a material history about this one mostly forgotten moment in time, which is the earliest recording of live music. And it was a recording made in 1888. This is haunting, beautiful recording made at London's Crystal Palace, this huge exhibition hall that was actually built to house one of the first World's Fairs. And it was called the Crystal Palace because it was, at the time, the largest plate glass building ever built. It had over 1 million square feet of exhibition space. But this recording, the moment in time that the world changed that we often don't reflect on, which is our ability to re-experience a live moment of sound, specifically music, which is something none of us ever reflects on. I mean, you're recording me now with technology that has an incredible, beautiful story in if you trace it back to its origins and about why humans would want to record sound at all. And to me, this piece is about this desire to hold on and capture and try to materialize the audible experience. And once, because the genius of that moment with Edison was that if you could materialize sound, then you could capture it and you could preserve it. And it's lost on us today, but think about why would people want such a technology? And at the time, nobody had access to live musical experiences unless you were there. So, you know, I like to, the analogy I use is think of reading a transcript of Patsy Cline performing and hearing Patsy Cline perform. The gap is so huge that they don't even seem like they should be on the same planet. But for most of recorded history, the vast amount of recorded history, the human experience of sound has been through transcripts, sheet music, word of mouth, never a real lived experience.
You talk about the difference qualitatively between a musical transcript and the actual sound of the music. And in a sense, this is sort of an artistic transcript that we're looking at here. And if you listen in this room, it's silent. You could have very easily, I imagine, filled this room with a cacophony of speakers and really made sound an overwhelming part of this exhibition. And I can only imagine that there was a purpose and a power to letting there be silence.
Right. And the viewer does have access to the recording as an individual. They can choose to put on headphones or not. But in general, I have chosen as an artist who's interested in sound to untap it in other ways. So the pieces treat each viewer almost like a walking jukebox so that, you know, there's a piece over there that references Frank Sinatra and Whitney Houston. So I'm counting on someone walking by and internally playing that song. And what I like about that is that we all bring our own baggage with us when we hear that song internally. It's a different way of thinking about sound existing in the world, in the room.
Let's go ahead and give our listeners an opportunity to hear what's on these headphones. I'm going to put this right up to the microphone. It's such a ghostly sound. I mean, you can barely hear that trace of a melody behind all the interference on the you know, sort of primitive audio recording technology it was made on.
And it was, I'm very interested in how the ability to record ourselves did change attitudes about life and death. I mean, it seems crazy to think that in our day and age, when we have the technological capabilities to just record everything all the time. But at the time, that was precious. It was the first voice that, as we just listened to, they are now immortalized in a way that never existed before that date.
If you're just joining us, you're tuned to The Signal. Aaron Henkin here with artist Dario Robleto. We're broadcasting from the Front Room Gallery at the Contemporary Wing at the Baltimore Museum of Art, the BMA, where Dario Robleto has an amazing exhibition on display here through March 29th. And Dario Robleto, what are we looking at here next?
So this is a piece called Melancholy Matters Because of You. And it's another meditation on time through sound, and specifically meditating on how we become who we are. We all know it, of course. We can speak about it quickly as a genetic process. But there's something I have a very personal experience with that I'm sure many, many people do, which is, did we become who we are partly because of what our parents were listening to while we were in the womb? And if you think about family lineage in this way, what did your grandmother listen to that had to have some bearing on who your mother or father became, which would then be passed down to you? But it's that moment from conception to birth that I'm most fascinated with about how we're understanding music.
So with that sort of philosophical pretext in mind, what we're actually looking at here, it appears to me, is a small lucite case here with three skeletons of hand bones.
Yes, and there are three ages represented. There are the fetal hand bone, a young child's hand bones, and an adult hand bone. And they are each made from melted vinyl records. The fetal hand bones are made from my grandmother's 78 records that I know she listened to extensively while my mother would have been in the womb. The middle hand bone is my mother's rock and roll records. Again, I know very directly that I'm partly here because of those records that she listened to. And then the final piece, sort of me as the adult and being a sum total of what they listened to, it's my own record collection that's been melted down into these hand bones. But one little thing I wanted to stress is that the reason they're bones and why they're at different developmental stages is because I wanted to imply that we literally become who we are. Our bones start to grow and change shape while musical information is being conveyed to us in the womb. And so I like to think that somewhere at a growth level of my actual bones, you know, we like to say something's in our bones, and, you know, I'm taking it quite literal here, that I became what I am as my mother did, as we could all argue at some level we became what we are because of musical decisions we didn't have a say in. That's another interesting point I'm making here, is that, you know, this nurture-nature discussion within biology is not usually talked about, as far as, you know, it's basically a little experiment occurring for 9 months with whatever your parents are listening to, and how that becomes forces you to become what you are in some way.
Dario Robleto talking with the Signal's Aaron Hankin this week at the BMA. Robledo's exhibition, Setlists for a Setting Sun, is on display in the museum's Front Room Gallery through March 29th. The artist will host an event in the gallery this Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m. when he'll be in conversation with composer Tim Nohy. After the talk, Robledo plans to invite visitors to join him in a group participation sound remix inspired by his work. You're tuned to The Signal, an original production of Your Public Radio in Baltimore.